Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a source of powerful free resources to help you as a parent or grandparent get equipped to invest in the faith of the next generation. Our Next Gen website has been designed to help empower you to navigate tough issues with the young people in your life. At Next Gen, you'll find articles, entertainment reviews from a Christian perspective, parenting stories, helpful parenting guides, and even answers to the tough questions. All these resources are free as you engage on the front line of raising the next generation for Jesus. So why not register today at premierinsight.org/resources to receive free resources from NextGen. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Briley, the show that brings you conversations that matter every Saturday afternoon here on Premier Christian Radio. Listen to around the world via our podcast. And if you haven't yet discovered the vast back catalogue of shows and resources, do go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Today on the show, we're discussing Hinduism, conversion and religious freedom. I'll be introducing my guests shortly, but I was delighted to bring you the news that the ticketing has opened for Unbelievable, the Conference 2020, announced that last week, along with the fact that alongside N.T. Wright, one of our keynote speakers, Tom Holland, best-selling historian and author of Dominion, is going to be part of the lineup. And we can also confirm that Sarah Lumgair, Bobby Conway, the one-minute apologist, Ruth Jackson and Jess Lester are among the speakers at this year's conference. And it certainly caught the imagination as well, our bold branding, our kind of movie poster style branding for this year's conference has created some chatter as well online. If you want to go and check it out, all the details, Saturday the 9th of May is when you need to be in London for it, but go and look at all the stuff available at unbelievable.live. That's unbelievable.live to be part of this year's Unbelievable Conference. And the back end of February, we're hoping to release some details about how you can attend if you're elsewhere in the world via the live stream, but always best experienced if you can be there in person. unbelievable.live. We'll have some of your feedback later on in the show, including some of your response to new music we've been trying out, the bumper music here on Unbelievable. And here's again something a little different as we get into today's show.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, tensions between Hindus and other religious groups in India have been growing in recent years. Freedom of religion in India is a fundamental right guaranteed by Article 25-28 of the Constitution of India. Yet, many Christians say they're prevented from sharing their faith with others and that a blind eye is being turned towards discrimination and violence. In fact, just 2 weeks ago, a prayer meeting of 250 pastors and their families was disrupted by Hindu nationalists in the South Indian state of Tamil Nadu. Now, nearly 1,500 physical attacks and death threats were reported against Christians in the past year. But many Hindus see Christian proselytism as a colonial attack on Hindu culture and are concerned that the religious culture and heritage of India is being harmed by the evangelism and outreach activities of certain Christian churches, often funded by support from Western Christians and churches. Well, today we're going to be talking about Hinduism, conversion and religious freedom. Henry joins me today. He's a representative of Christian Solidarity Worldwide. It's a charity that works with persecuted Christians around the world. I'm also joined by Deepan Rajaguru of the Hindu Council UK. He's their Director for Equality and Human Rights. So Deepan and Henry, thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
It's a pleasure.
Perhaps we'll introduce you first, Henry, and maybe say right up at the front, that is actually a pseudonym, and we've chosen not to film today's show either. Because of the sensitive nature of the work that you undertake with Christian Solidarity Worldwide, supporting Christians in South Asia. But tell us a little bit, though, of your background. You're from an Indian background yourself, is that the
yes,
case?
I'm from an Indian background myself. I was born into a Christian family, grew up both as a Catholic, and went to a Protestant church. But at a personal level, you know, I found Christ, and I found the teachings of the Bible real to me. And one thing I did learn is how to pray and see God really at times when, you know, things seemed bleak, and I've seen his hand come true many times in my life at a very personal level.
And have you had opportunity, both in your professional and personal life, to engage with Hindus and people obviously of other faiths in that way?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, my childhood friend is a Sikh, and I've got many Hindu friends, not to mention friends who are Buddhists, some atheists, and Muslims as well. And yeah, speaking of Hindu friends, we grew up together, went to school together. I've been to temples. I've enjoyed going to the temples. And with my Sikh friends, I enjoy making laddus during wedding ceremonies, you know. Yes, it's been a great time just growing up. Obviously, in this day and age, we are also seeing tensions between religious groups, which is really unnecessary, that's taking place, and it's concerning, and I guess that's why we are here to talk about
it. Yeah, I want to talk to you about that. Perhaps we'll get into that in a moment's time, and some of the concerns that are out there. But Deepan, you're a Hindu, and you've come here to represent the Hindu Council UK. Tell us firstly a little bit about the Hindu Council UK. What do they do?
Well, the Hindu Council UK is a charity based in the UK. It's an amalgamation of various Hindu denominations throughout the UK, consisting of temple bodies, cultural organisations, community groups, and youth and women's organisations that we represent.
Brilliant. And you are a Hindu yourself, obviously. What would you say, in a nutshell, and we won't have time to lay it out in great detail, but what are the central tenets for you of Hinduism?
Hinduism, in a nutshell, is quite difficult to define. But essentially, it's a collection of complex ritual and spiritual knowledge in the pursuit of self-knowledge, which is the highest goal in Hinduism. It's often called a way of life because it defines a process of living where every action that you perform is a continuous form of worship, and it's an expression of devotion. And that's what it is in a nutshell.
Yes. Tell us a little bit about the history of Hinduism in India specifically. I understand, a very ancient religion in that sense.
Yes, it's the oldest living religion in the world, and it's very ancient. The roots of it have not been defined as such, have not been discovered. It's not reliant on a single person or a messiah. Mm-hmm. It's a collection of information and spiritual knowledge, which everyone can practice as they wish. So there's no single God, but there is there's no need for a single Messiah. Mm. But generally, Hindus believe in a single God,
right? That may have manifestations in a multiple.
That's right. That's right. 330 million. Yes. Manifestations.
And to what extent, you know, if you went to India, would you find that the culture there is, I suppose, organized around Hinduism to a far greater degree, presumably, than you would find cultures organized possibly around Christianity here, or what?
Yes, I mean, generally, Hinduism is very broad-minded. It's a very gentle way of life, and it's not interested at all in campaigning or conversion or proselytization. Hindus don't indulge in violence. It's not something that we hold as a strong suit, nor do we wish to. I mean, this came out as an example when, in terms of the colonial era, when the British were there, the process of ahimsa, non-violence, which was promulgated by Mahatma Gandhi, was something which the British had never encountered before. It was non-violence in the face of adversity, and this was a basic Hindu tenet which really won India its independence.
Coming back to you, Henry, how would you sort of describe the religious makeup of India? Because obviously it's a country with a variety of different religious traditions side by side. I'd be interested to hear sort of what proportion of those are Christians, Muslims, Hindu, other faiths, and where some of these tensions exist within the country as well.
So in the 2011 census in India, the statistics come up. So we're looking at round figures here, about 79% of the population in India are Hindus. Muslims make up about 14% of the population. Christians about 2.5. Sikhs between 1.7 to 2%. Buddhists 0.7%, and Jains about 0.3%. And as Deepan has said, it's a nation of Hindus have been in the region for many years, for millennia, and the tensions really has risen since we've seen the politicization of a religion. Now, just to say, Christianity has been in India far longer than it has been in the British Isle.
Right.
Thomas, the disciple of Christ, was known to have brought Christianity
to
the shores of India, and hence the growth of Christianity in India. So it's been there for almost 2,000 years.
And even though it's a relatively small proportion of the overall population, it's still hundreds of thousands, millions, I assume, of Christians.
We're looking at about 26 million people, which, if you put it in perspective, it's...
it's half the population of the UK, you know.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Right, almost the population of Nepal, really.
Yeah, yeah. So in a sense, as much as obviously in a very large nation, it's a relatively small percentage, there's still a great number of Christians in India. And you say it's politicization that is... And we've already heard from Deepan that, in his view, Hinduism at its core is not a violent religion. So what are you seeing? What's happening in your experience? CSW obviously are very concerned at some of the issues that are arising when it comes to the difficulties certain parts of the Christian church are facing there.
So what we are seeing is intolerance towards other religious, minority religious groups, particularly Christians and Muslims, has been around for a number of decades. I mean, I think we can say Hindus and Christians have been living in relative harmony for hundreds and thousands of years. You know, I think we can say that. But it's only in the turn of the century, particularly in the early years of the 1900s, we have seen the formation of groups that promote intolerance and hatred for the other. And to just name a couple, Savarkar, who's the ideologue of what we know today as the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, the RSS, which was later established as in 1925 as a social body in India, which has got almost 6 million membership in its membership, has been promoting this idea of, has been urging Hindus to constitute a single nation and build a Hindu Rashtra, a Hindu nation, and to Hinduize politics and to militarize the Hindu.
Right.
And Golwalkar, who had come on later, and in his book, We or Our Nationhood Defined, had made reference to Nazi Germany and had actually used examples of Hitler and the use of how one treats the other. So Christians, Muslims particularly, has been used by these people,
through the RSS,
to promote intolerance, that Christians and Muslims are the other.
This RSS, they are essentially a kind of a Hindu nationalist body. And are they linked to the ruling party, the BJP, in India, which, as I understand it, is also quite heavily influenced by Hindu nationalism?
So the RSS, we could say, is the umbrella body that has been around since 1925. And I might like to add also here that the RSS was proscribed several times in history back in 1948 after the assassination of Gandhi.
And were they involved in
that? Yes. There was an RSS person who was involved in the assassination of the Mahatma. So it's been proscribed and then reinstated again. The RSS is the ideological body that promotes this idea of the other and this idea of creating a Hindu Rashtra in India. The BJP is the political arm of the RSS.
Okay.
So many of the leaders in the BJP today were trained by the RSS, belong to the RSS.
It sounds, and perhaps this isn't a great analogy, but a little bit like the Irish Republican Army, the IRA in Ireland, Northern Ireland, and Sinn Féin being the political wing, if you like, of that movement. But what's your, I mean, Deepan, I know very little of these issues. I'm sure you're far more familiar, obviously, as is Henry. But what's your view of organisations like the RSS and obviously the BJP itself?
Well, they are recent phenomena in the history of India. India and Hinduism has an ancient civilization. And so we really need to take it right back, not just focus on what's happening over the last century, if at all, in that sense. If we take it back over 1,000 years, India has been invaded, and it was colonized. It was first invaded by the Mughals, who are Muslim, and then the Christians came over with, in terms of the colonies and colonization of
India.
And
the empire, yeah.
And the empire. Mm. So it, and then, but to focus that on saying, well, it's India's fault and it's Indian Hindus' problem, is perhaps quite short-sighted, because we're talking about an issue which goes over 1,000 years ago, where invaders came, took the country, looted the country, and prospered from this. So then for us to say from a Western perspective, well, it was Hindus and it was your problem and it's you
see these movements as a reaction to that history.
Well, proselytization and conversion is a very foreign concept to Hindus.
Right.
It's something that we would never do. It's nothing that has come to India before. It didn't originate in India, so the field is sort of tilted against Hindus when you bring in the factor of conversion and proselytization. It's pointing the finger at them.
Right.
Whereas we should look at the wider picture of it, saying, well, actually, we were the people who came, not necessarily invited, but came over and tried to change these people's culture, perhaps without little knowledge of what that culture was and quite ignorant of what it was. So it's trying to impose something which is quite foreign onto a nation, and not expect any friction.
Right. I mean, where do you stand personally on the way that that's being manifested in the RSS and so on and their activities? Do you sort of deplore that, or do you say no? It's understandable, and there is some just cause in
it's deplorable in the short term, but if you look at it in terms of historical principles and values, it's a natural reaction.
Okay.
If somebody comes to your house uninvited and says, I'm going to take over your kitchen, and you can only come to the kitchen if you believe in what I say, you're not going to be best pleased
with
that.
Is that what you see Christians specifically doing, or at least historically happening?
Historically happening, because right. These were invasions over 1,000 years, where, from the Mughal Empire to the British Empire, coming over, taking and looting.
What's your response to that sort of way of seeing the history as being one of the Hindu people essentially being invaded by other religious traditions that have actually not been helpful in that way? Henry?
I will take another approach or perspective of what Deepan has just said, and is to go back to my previous point that Christianity has been in India far before the colonial rule, far before. And Christians and Hindus have been living in relative harmony for many, many years. That's one. Secondly, I think it's important to make a distinction between Hindu practices, Hinduism as a religion, and this notion of Hindutva, which the RSS has been propagating.
And what is that notion?
So Hindutva, in principle, basically means the politicization of Hinduism.
Okay.
So to take it to a level where it becomes very nationalistic, it becomes intolerant in its very root and nature, and therefore it promotes a narrative of treating the other, i.e. the person who does not belong to the motherland or the fatherland, that Hindu, that India is principally a Hindu nation, and therefore these are infiltrators, these are foreigners. Because this was what the ideologues of the RSS have been promoting since 1925. So what we have seen since 1925 has been a push towards policies, or even, and if you look at it empirically, the kind of hate that actually takes place on the ground at the civil society level has been hatreds towards Christians and Muslims.
What does that manifest as? Because we've been talking in general terms here, but what specific cases? I mean, I mentioned one recently of this meeting of pastors and their families disrupted, but what does that look like? I mean, is this simply intimidation? What sort of thing are you seeing happen in some of the friction spots in India?
I think that ranges, Justin. It ranges from harassment, intimidation, to outright killing and murder, and even rape. now, these are done by those who buy into the Hindutva ideology of treating the other. So, once again, I would like to say there is a difference, a distinction between those who actually practice Hinduism and those who actually embrace the idea of Hindutva.
The ideology of this particular...
Now, to give you one big example is, I think we would all have read, and perhaps one of the largest pogrom against Christians that took place in 2007-2008 in the state of Odisha, formerly known as Orissa, in the district of Kandamal. What had happened was a religious leader who belonged to the Hindutva organization called the Vishwa Hindu Parishad, which is the religious arm of the RSS, was assassinated not by Christians but by Maoist groups who had actually come out to say and admitted that they had carried out the assassination. Right. And what followed on after that was probably one of the largest documented attack on the Christian community in India. Over 90 people were killed, and over 54,000 Christians were displaced in Kandamal district, and over 300 churches were burned. And what had happened before that, that preceded before the attack, was incitement of hatred towards Christians, although the Maoists had come on to say that we had done it, we had killed
them. They had taken responsibility.
Yes.
It was nevertheless deflected back to the Christian population.
It was deflected back to Christians. So you have leaders both in the BJP, in the political front, and also within the RSS, within its many outfits of the RSS, who are inciting that hatred. And what we are hearing these days, that it is, the numbers have grown exponentially. And this is empirical. This is what we hear from the ground. There are parts in India, in tribal regions in India, where we've seen communities, Christian communities, who've been told that they will not have access to rationing, which means access to the food, the oil, the basic necessities in life, because they have embraced Christianity.
And I mean, this obviously goes against the stated national position on religious freedom. Deepen, but what, obviously on the ground things can look different though, so how do you respond to that, and what do you think is the solution to some of these tensions?
Well, the solution, I guess, is not to politicize Hinduism from a Western perspective, which is what we've been doing, really. So it's pointing fingers and creating, making Hinduism political in the eyes of the West. Very few regions in the world have accepted Christianity into the region as India has, and where Christians have been able to tell the story quite freely, and it's been amicable. You know, Hinduism is very accepting. It accepts all faith in that sense, and it will listen to everyone. So we've got to ask the question, so if Hinduism accepts faith and it allows freedom of religion in its core, where did the problem come from? Obviously, if you're saying, well, it's a Hindus, it's a falsehood, because Hinduism allows people to come and preach and live there. India has never invaded any other country, and it's allowed religions to come and bear fruit in India, and Hindus are quite happy for that to happen. It's part of that faith.
Do you feel then, I mean, it sounds like you're saying, as far as these organizations, RSS and so on, exist, they're responding to a kind of aggressive forms of proselytism and cultural sort of indoctrination or something like that. Do you share the underlying concerns there about what that does to India as Christians or Muslims, whoever, want to spread their ideas and their religion in the country?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, like I say, the fundamental basic right laws in Hinduism, if you can call that, is non-violence and to be accepting and to listen to other people. One thing we have to realise is in India, there is no belief system. Hinduism is not a belief system. You don't believe in it. India has been and is a region, an area of seekers, where people seek information, seek spirituality. So when you're trying to impose a belief, it agitates people, and at worst, it makes people very angry. And I think that's what we've got to look at. It's the angry form, which is not right, and it's not Hindu. So you can't make that into a Hindu concept.
Is that what you see happening, though? But I suppose, keeping with the Christian idea here, I mean, I can understand there are certain forms of Islam which can be seen as oppressive, but generally speaking, most Christians that I see tend to be evangelizing through peaceful means. They're not forcing anyone necessarily to believe. Now, obviously, there may be instances in the past where that was not really the case, but today, would you say we are, you know, that there is a genuine threat in India of people somehow being forced to accept Christianity?
It depends what we mean by the term force and what we mean, like, in terms of duress, because it can be that we can look at Christians taking advantage of the vulnerable and vulnerable areas and the poor.
What sort of thing?
And try to essentially say that, you know, you can only come to Christianity if you accept and be baptized, for example, and therefore you will have access to education and what we may offer. So it's not a force as such, but it's duress to say, well, you know, dangling the carrot in front of poor people and say you can only have this carrot if you come through us.
You think there's an element of that in some of the conversion going on, that it's if you become a Christian, then you'll get education, food, welfare.
Oh,
and so
yes,
on.
And it's a fact. I mean, the church owns vast swathes of land in India. It's one of the biggest landlords and landowners in India, and it creates a lot of tension amongst local communities as well, where you're dangling the carrot, saying you can only come to me, or you can only take part if you are baptized, for example.
We'll come back to this, and we'll have a response from Henry in a moment's time. But we've reached the end of the first part of the program already, discussing Hinduism, conversion, and religious freedom in India. My guests today are Henry from Christian Solidarity Worldwide and Deepan from the Hindu Council UK.
Premier Christianity Magazine in this month's issue.
Nona Jones is a top executive at Facebook. Here's her advice to Christians on social media.
It doesn't matter how many followers you have if those followers are not following Jesus through you. We're meant to be conduits of the gospel. If we're building followings to ourselves and to our own brands, then we've missed the mark. And that's just the truth.
Read the full interview, plus news, features, reviews, and more, exclusively in Premier Christianity Magazine.
For your free copy, visit premierchristianity.com/free sample.
You're listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Welcome back to today's show. Hinduism, conversion, and religious freedom is what we're talking about on Unbelievable today. I'm Justin Brierley, and my guests are Henry. He's from Christian Solidarity Worldwide, and with supporting Christians in South Asia specifically, and he's here to talk about what he sees as some of the concerns in India over the rights that are in principle guaranteed in the constitution of India for freedom of religion, but it says on the ground not so much. And we've been hearing about some of the issues that have existed in different parts of the Hindu and Christian community. Deepan Rajaguru of the Hindu Council UK is also here to give his perspective on this, and he believes that often the history of proselytization in India accounts for some of the animosity that exists. And in that last section, Deepan was saying, Henry, that he sees that there are problems. It may not be that anyone's being forced exactly to believe, but when Christianity is offered alongside welfare, education, food, and so on, it's a carrot that's being dangled, and that in itself can be a form of duress. And how would you respond to sort of some of the, I suppose, strategies, ways in which Christianity has been spread in India and continues to be spread?
Well, let me just say in the right from the beginning, the ownership of land or the size of the land that you own or property that you own does not automatically mean that you are guilty of giving gifts or alluring someone to become Christian. That in itself does not mean that you are guilty of that. I'd just like to give an example. In 1999, there was an Australian missionary working in the state of Orissa, which we just spoke about. His name is Graham Staines. He was there with his family for a good number of years and he was actually supporting the poor there, in the sense he had set up hospitals to help those who were leprous, because no one in that social level was actually being helped, who belonged to that sort of community. And here's a man who had actually gone out to provide assistance and help because no one else was doing it. Sadly, in 1999, both him and his son, they were burnt alive as they slept overnight in their truck. And there was a lot of accusation that came at the back of that to say that he was proselytizing, he was offering help to these people, and therefore he was instigating the social structure there and alluring them into Christianity. But he wasn't. What he was doing was he was helping out those in that particular time of need to feel accepted. So I think it's important to do a distinction between the intent of the the Christian and really what is actually taking place. And I think one has to look at cases. And I think we cannot do a blanket assessment of this thing, of the situation. I think the real issue is that Christianity is seen as socially disruptive. In that sense, it is viewed as socially disruptive by, and I would say, not necessarily by Hindus, no. Once again, I would like to draw the attention to the RSS or the Hindutva movement, those who proselytize or push towards intolerance, in the sense that what they propagate is converts cease to think, act, or dress as Indians, and they abandon their tradition.
Right.
And therefore, this is non-acceptable. And I also would like to say that Christianity may be seen as taking a view of how secularists do, where they promote or they propagate or they ask for the right or they demand for the right to actually live and practice and propagate their religion. And what Hindutva, the ideology in Hindutva promotes is that, no, you should not have that right.
Do you believe in the right of Christians to live their faith and share their faith with others? Or do you have a problem with that yourself, Deepan?
No, not at all. I mean, like I said, Hinduism is all about learning and learning from other faiths and other people. It doesn't mean that you have to believe in that. I mean, it's very easy to like the teachings of Jesus, and accept them. There is no, there in Hinduism, there is no problem or issue with that. The problem or issue comes with when you have various barriers to accept that.
Well, for instance, you know, many Christians may say that part of what it is to believe in Jesus Christ as Lord and Savior is to believe that he is the only way to salvation. Now, do you find that offensive? Is that something, as a Hindu, you would say goes against Hindu culture in some way?
It just does not make sense to Hinduism because, like I say, we're a nation of and people of seekers, not believers. So you can't force people to believe in a certain way when they'll ask questions. Hindus will ask questions, and they often do. They ask questions in their own stories in sure. Hinduism of their gods. They won't believe. Each incarnation of God was questioned.
Do you find, though, that if say, that is the claim being put across by the Christian, say, to a Hindu, they're being invited to believe that Jesus is the only way to God, is that something you still would support a Christian's right to say, to preach, if you like, or do you think actually, no, that shouldn't be allowed?
I think what Henry said was good in the sense, there's a, in terms of the intention. I think there is the role of intention, but also you know, there's the proverb, I don't know if it's a Christian proverb, but the road to hell is paved with good intention. So these individuals may have good intention, but they are creating division in society, which they may not know of or are ignorant of. And then if something happens, the community is blamed. And that, to me, does not sound fair. However horrendous the outcome, and you know, it is horrendous, people being burnt or killed, but it's come out of a tension which they may have created inadvertently. Or
I suppose the tension then is, but it's obviously you don't want to see divisions created that lead to society, you know, not being able to function properly. But at the same time, does that mean prohibiting the right of Christians to share their faith openly and prohibiting Hindus from potentially accepting and becoming Christians themselves? Because it sounds like you're saying we're open to everyone, but I'm worried if it actually starts to change the balance, if you like, in Hinduism.
Not necessarily the balance. I'm concerned about how divisive and the methods of it is.
Right.
I mean, there are many examples I can give, as Henry has given, where Christians have... There was a recent example case currently, you know, where there's a building which is inhabited mainly by Christians, and they are preventing Hindus from praying with that building, and that's a particular case happening now in India. Many of these examples we can give to each other. But it doesn't mean it's each one is bad. It means there's an issue that needs to be resolved. I said here that, you know, Hinduism is quite accepting and is happy to listen to various bits of knowledge. Again, there's this other adage that there is only one truth, but the wise men know it by many names. It's that type of spiritual enlightenment and knowledge which India has been brought up in, or Indians and Hindus sure. have been brought up in.
I mean, do you fundamentally agree with Deepan there, Henry, that there's an openness in Hinduism, but what about the division that potentially is caused when people are encouraged to change their beliefs and, you know, for something which is fundamentally quite different to their Hindu background?
Mm. Well, I mean, I would say, with the case that Deepan's just mentioned, wherever this place, this incident is taking place, or if it's taken place in the past, I believe that there is a need for dialogue and for openness and discussion. And I believe Hindus and Christians alike are willing to do that, like I said, because it is a country that was founded on an understanding. It's a nation that has had so many religions, and some of the oldest religions in the world came from India. But the concerning thing is when those who wield power use the religion to perpetuate more hatred. And this is where the problem lies. And there is no steps being taken to stop that from actually developing or mushrooming in all of India. So I think I would say that one other thing is the fact that the constitution in India, which is principally a constitution which is based on secularism. There was a move not too long ago by the former Home Minister, Rajnath Singh, to debate in the Lok Sabha, that's the lower houses in Parliament, to remove the term secularism. But that's been shelved at the moment. But I won't be surprised if they come back to it. But generally, there has been a move to try and create a law that's at a national level, which is anti-conversion in its nature.
To prohibit
the
conversion specifically
from taking place.
Yeah.
Now,
I mean, what do you think of those kinds of moves to create that kind of law prohibiting conversion?
I don't think that would happen. India is secularism which was inserted into the constitution, but by rights, India is a plural or a pluralistic area. So it believes everyone has the right for religion, knowledge, or whatever they have. So by trying to make it into a specific may not occur, but at the end of the day, if it does occur, Hinduism is a pluralistic religion. It accepts everyone from everywhere, there's no intention of creating friction within it. And this is where, you know, quite rightly, politics sours the milk in that sense, because Christians and Hindus get along very well. For example, I mean, if we were to say, Look at the countries where Hindus have settled. Here in the UK, for example, you know, we've not come and say we want to establish a Hindutva here. We don't want a Hindu state or Hindu national. So, and in terms of Hindus in this country, we've got the lowest crime rate, the highest GDP contributions amongst, and the highest form of educations. So, what have we done which is so wrong? As the Hindus, our beliefs are not about creating tension and creating ill will. There's, again, another famous saying. I'm sorry to come out with all these sayings, but I think it comes from the Zoroastrian, actually, where when they came to India and they came to the kingdom, and the king said, well, you know, we're happy to accept you. There's no problem. And the Zoroastrian said, you know, you probably know this, where they said, we will be like a glass of milk. We won't change anything, but we will be, you'll see us as sugar in a glass of milk.
Okay.
You're not going to change anything, but we'll make the society that little bit sweeter.
Mm. Yeah.
So this is what Hinduism does wherever it goes. So its fundamental belief is making it life, society, sweeter for everyone who's there, not just whatever creed, culture, religion you are. It's for everyone.
I mean, how do you respond to that, Henry? Obviously, I'm sure you would agree that Hinduism, when it goes out into other countries, yes, it tends to live very peaceably and flourishes with other people. The problem seems to be in the other direction. As Christians or Muslims, whoever go to the Hindu country, it can create these tensions.
I think you need to look at it a bit more in depth, and I'm not sure whether we would have the time here to look into that. But I think anyone is capable of good and evil. Let's face it. Let's take the religion out of this. Humanity in itself, every one of us are capable. Now, what are we and who are we listening to? And how are we responding to what we are listening to? And this is the crux of the matter. So whether it's Hindus, whether it's Christians or Muslims, I believe that the community, the individuals, wherever they go, they can flourish. But what have they exposed themselves to? Which is the real question. So I think what's important is, what is India being exposed to today?
Mm-hmm.
What are they listening? What are they hearing? What are they taking into their hearts? And what I see is that, given that those who wield that power have access to communication, has access to resources and are therefore able to communicate a narrative of intolerance towards the other, which is really causing the problems. Now, to be honest with you, the influence of the RSS has gone beyond the shores of India. You know, it has gone to the Far East. It's come to the West. It's even gone to the Americas. They're big supporters of the RSS in this part of the world and also in Americas.
That's from Hindu communities that exist in those parts of the world. They are supporting the kind of
the
Hindu nationalist ideology back home.
Correct, the nationalist idea back home. So I think we can't go on the basis that, okay, we migrate to a country, we may not impose our ways in them. I think you need to look at other checklists as well. I mean, if a particular group are being economically marginalized, they tend to rise up and react.
I mean, but Deepan's problem is, you know, you can understand where this impetus comes from because of the division that he sees it creating when Christians come and say, this is what you must believe in order to be saved, that there is only one way. Mm. And Deepan says that goes fundamentally against, you know, the Hindu way of life, the Hindu approach to faith and religion. Mm. And for him, that's a big problem. Mm. And so I think he wants to say, we want to be open, but we don't want to be open to things that potentially disrupt our culture that, you know, we have been happy and flourished in for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that. I mean, my response to Deepan would be, if there is a notion of openness, then openness comes with choice, that you're open to hear your presentation to me of your Christianity, of your Islam, or your Buddhism, or whatever it may be, and therefore I have the choice to choose to reject it or not to to embrace it. So I think what's important is that choice must be available. And India particularly is a nation that has been built on choice. We have Article 25. We have the preamble that speaks of the secular state. So if we talk of a religion being open, then one needs to have that openness to either choose to accept, to embrace it, or to reject it. Now, obviously, there might be cases of fraud, for example, or an allurement. It's not something that I would say that Christians operate in that way. Let me give you an example. There are several states in India that has they call them Freedom of Religion Acts. It's a bit of a euphemism, really. It's not really Freedom of Religion Act. They're fundamentally anti-conversion laws that prohibits conversion. There are several states. Out of them, about seven states have active enforcement of the law. Now, they're fundamentally the same. They're worded the same. But fraud, for example, is one of the terms of conversion, that you may not convert someone through fraud. Mm-hmm. Now, let me put forward a hypothetical situation. At a Christian gathering, there is an offer of, let's say, fraud is misrepresentation. Let's say there's prayer taking place and people are believing to be healed of their disease or of their ailments. Now, we all know healing does not happen instantaneously. Sometimes it does. Mm. Sometimes it takes over time. Sometimes it doesn't happen immediately. Now, would you say that the person who had gone out to be prayed for, who had not received healing, but has accepted the Christian teaching, the Christian God, would that tantamount to fraud?
Would that be a victim of fraud at that point?
Exactly.
What do you say to this, Deepan? Interested in your response.
I think if you're going out to a group of people and offering them, in that case, a healing from a disease, that's a carrot I'm talking about in that sense. You will get free of disease if you come to Christ or if you believe in our way of religion or our religion. And that's taking advantage of vulnerable people in a vulnerable state. And it's fundamentally flawed if that's your way of dialogue.
So you would say there is a a just case to be made for these laws about around fraud and anti-conversion laws, where it may be taking place in a way that you think is not ethically sound?
Well, laws would be based upon how people would on the ethics of it, essentially, and whether it's right or wrong. And I think it's flawed when you're promising something which you're unable to deliver. I mean, we've got the Consumer Rights Act and things in this country where, you know, you can't offer something which is not fit for purpose. So if you're dangling a carrot saying we will cure you of your religions or your ills and not deliver on that, that is fraud.
Okay. What do you say to that, Henry?
I would say that you cannot legislate on issues of religion in that sense. I think what we've seen in India is we've seen the role of the state trying to step into the homes and private lives of people. With religion, it's very hard to say. Conversion, for example. I mean, conversion, the word conversion is a taboo word in many parts in South Asia, because it is seen as something where I'm stepping into you, your religion, and I'm pulling you away from that religion. So it's a very taboo language, a taboo word, actually. But where do you say this is not fraud or this is not an allurement? Mm. Where do you
put the line?
Put the lines.
Yeah.
And if it's in the hands of an administrator or an adjudicator who is very biased, then you're going to have a decision swinging in the favor of those who are against religious freedom, for example.
I'd be interested to know just how frequent this is anyway. I mean, are you seeing in India significant numbers of Hindus converting to Christianity in parts of the country?
I don't have numbers for you at this moment. The propagation of Christianity, and likewise, as the law says, it can go either way. Christians are free to convert into Islam or to Buddhism. I mean, I would say that within my own extended family, I have Christians who've married into a Hindu family and practice Hindu traditions.
Right.
And they've not come any form of criticism or attack or ostracization by the family. I've got Muslims in my family too, extended family.
Does it happen the other way? Do you experience Christian Hindus who become Christians who are then ostracized by their community because of that?
Hindus who become Christians and then ostracized by their communities, not personally, by their family, but... What is important really is to really look at these laws. I feel these laws have really expanded and extended into private homes of people and dictate to people how they should conduct their lives. Let me give you another example, if I may. The issue of force is another example within the anti-conversion laws. And force simply means where you see the threat of divine displeasure. Now, in Christianity, for example, or maybe even in other religions, when there is the sharing of the faith, there could be a narrative that, you know, if you do not accept Christ as your personal savior, you may be damned in hell, for example.
Yeah.
I'm just giving an example. Yeah. This is a very real example.
Yeah.
Would that then tantamount to divine displeasure? You know, inviting divine displeasure. How do you put a finger on it and say that is actually divine displeasure?
And is that what's being legislated against in some of these?
That is the definition that is in the laws that we see. So the laws are in itself very ambiguous, very broad. Till today, we've not seen one single conviction in India of someone being convicted under these laws, not one.
What do you make of these sorts of laws, Deepan? Do you think they are necessary in India? Do you think they are...
No, I guess if there's no... In terms of if no one's been criminalised under that law, then, you know, it's worth looking at in terms of whether it's needed or not. But what we've got to look at is the wider picture here, and that... the other, who's the, you've often talked about the other, but who's the other in India? Is it the Hindus who make up 80% of the population, or is it people who are coming in to the country to proselytize and convert. And when people are coming in for a particular mission, and they're calling Hindus the other, it's like coming into your house and saying that you don't own it, we're owning it, and you're the other person in this house. It's not something which is used. The law should not be used as a weapon. The law should be always used as a shield. So I think when it's used as it should be, as a shield, and in terms of not around forced conversion, I think that's very good. That's how the law should be used. People should not be forced to convert. It's up to the judges to decide, you know,
a forced conversion.
Yeah, in a particular case.
And for you, there are these grey areas where is sort of potentially when benefits are being offered to someone who does convert.
If you're dangling carrots and education and healing and all manner of things, it can be argued
in principle, you support the right of any Hindu person to become a Christian if that is what they sincerely desire.
If they sincerely desire that, there is no issue with that. Hinduism, like I say, is all encompassing. It could integrate Christianity into it in that sense.
The problem when the Christian says you cannot be a Hindu and a Christian?
No, exactly.
Is that the problem?
It is a problem because it's saying it's my way or the highway. You believe in what I believe. I've come into your country. You believe in what I believe. But I'm not going to believe in what you believe.
Because I understand this from other Hindu friends I've spoken to who are very open to the idea of Christ as another guru, another source of wisdom, mm-hmm. another religious teacher.
Yeah.
But what they struggle with is the idea that only that truth is the truth.
Yeah.
And that seems to be the tension point a lot of the time.
It is. I mean, that's a fundamental issue in Hinduism because, like I said, you know, we don't have that. We don't see religion as a belief system where you blindly believe in something. It's always seeking, it's always questioning, and it's always trying to find out the truth. And it's a journey.
Yeah. The problem is, what if some people do come to the conclusion that journey leads them to the idea that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life, and that Hinduism is not that path?
That is their journey.
Yeah.
That is their journey. They should not be forcing other people onto their path, onto their journey. They should be enlightening these people to say, this is my journey and this is what I've learnt, and they should be open to the fact that these other people will say, great, I love that journey, I love where you've got to, however I'm on my own journey and you can't and you shouldn't be forcing me off that.
I suppose the real question is, what counts as force though in these cases, Henry?
I mean, what tantamounts to force? And like I said earlier, there's been many charges brought against Christians for proselytizing or propagating the religion. But till this date, I've not heard of one conviction taking place. And I just wanted to pick another point that Deepan said about looking at another religion through your lens of the way you look at your religion. And I think there can be a danger in that, in the sense that if we speak of a society or particular religion that has a sense of openness for dialogue, for an opportunity for choice to be made, then I think it's important to give an opportunity to the other religion or those who propagate the other religion to then share their belief structure, their belief system, therefore presenting an opportunity for choice to be made. I think there is a danger to view another religion from your own lenses of how you perceive religion should be. So, for example, as you said, Deepan, I mean, if Hinduism sees all religion as, you have a myriad of belief and an opportunity to think through this and to freely embrace your faith. And if you have Christianity that says, okay, it sounds almost arrogant that, okay, I am the way, the truth, and the life, you know. And to others, it may be seen as, oh, who gives you that monopoly to say that, really? But if that religion propagates that, then that idea or that understanding or that doctrine of that religion, all it's saying is, this is what it says. And now it's for the one that it's been presented to make the choice whether I should take this religion or not. But that freedom to propagate that religion, because fundamentally for Christians, it's the Bible that directs the Christian's life and his belief or her belief structure. So if the Bible says, and if Christ said, and Christ did say, I am the way, the truth, and the life, then that is what you would work with, and that's what you live through, and that's what you would propagate. And therefore, it is for the recipient of that message to then decide, is he really the way, the truth, and the life? Let me experience it. And if we say that there needs to be that openness, then let this person go on that journey.
We're going to take another quick break, and we'll wrap up today's conversation shortly. Fascinating one today, Hinduism, conversion, and religious freedom. And we'll be back with the final part with my guests Henry and Deepan very shortly.
If you listen to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley on Premier Christian Radio and enjoy the conversations between Christians and skeptics, then this is the perfect app for you. For the latest updates, podcasts, videos, articles, bonus content, and much more, download the Premier Unbelievable app today.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the show. If you want more info on the guest joining me for today's discussion on Hinduism, conversion and religious freedom, then do go and check out the show page at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And that's got links to things like our video channel as well over on YouTube. Lots of views of the latest debate that we've posted up there between Max Baker-Heitch and Alex O'Connor, the cosmic skeptic. That was the debate on the argument from reason. And we'll have some of your feedback to that towards the end of today's show. Also, links there, of course, to Unbelievable, the book, the app, ways to give as well, all kinds of different ways you can engage with Unbelievable. Coming up straight after today's show on the profile, I'm sitting down with Noel Tredinnick, a marvellous person. We're great friends, and he's been the leader of, for many years, the All Souls Choir and Orchestra. He founded Prom Praise, which happens every year at the Royal Albert Hall. He'll be talking about his 70 years of music ministry, quite a legacy he leaves behind him, and what the future holds as well. He's still going strong. So listen out for that straight after Unbelievable, 4 till 5, but also available on its own profile podcast. Next week here on Unbelievable, John Mark Comer joins me. He's a pastor from Portland, Oregon, and he's a regular listener of Unbelievable himself, actually. But he's got a great new book out called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. And I'm getting him in conversation with an atheist Buddhist called Rachel Holmes. You'll hear their conversation, a different kind of conversation actually, on our hurry-driven, anxiety-laden, tech-addicted culture. So listen out for that on the podcast and the radio show, same time next week. Still to come, of course, some of your feedback on recent editions of the show, including what you've been saying about some of the different music I've been trying out on the Unbelievable shows over the past few weeks. I had some interesting reactions as well to our Unbelievable Conference 2020 branding, and the fact that our branding for this year has gone with something like Star Wars and Marvel meets the Bible, with Tom Wright, Tom Holland, myself, Ruth Jackson and Sarah Lumger there on the poster. And if you want to find out more about it, as I've said before, we're getting all the details together. What we know so far is up on the website. You can find out more about the speakers, about the time, about what it'll cost you to attend. We've got our early bird tickets available right now. This is a good moment to book in. That's at unbelievable.live. And of course, it's in London on Saturday, the 9th of May. But in response to the movie style poster, friend of the show, Tom, who runs the Hiding in Plain Sight podcast, said, "This is awesome. What a lineup too. Although I do hope you leave your Princess Leia gold bikini at home, Justin. Ron Smurgundy was epic, but a Leia episode 6 costume might be a space jump too far." Yes, I don't think I'll attempt to come in character for this one. Thank you very much, Tom, for getting in touch. Tom Holland, one of the speakers at this year's conference, has recently written for Premier Christianity magazine on the back of his book Dominion and his appearance on The Big Conversation with A.C. Grayling, debating history and Christianity. Wrote a great article, really riffing off that question that A.C. Grayling asked during that show. Name for me one thing that Christianity gave us that doesn't have some precedent in ancient history or classical culture. And he wrote a fulsome response to that, which you can find online. I've posted it up on the Unbelievable Facebook and Twitter in the past week as well. Scott Mitchell got in touch on Twitter to respond to that and said Tom Holland's response reminds me of David Wallace's analogy. Two young fish swimming happen to meet an older fish swimming who says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit. And then eventually one of them looks at the other and goes, "What the hell is water?" And the idea being that we often don't realise the nature of the water we're swimming in, or don't even realise we're swimming in it when it comes to the Christian culture that has shaped the West. Thank you very much. Anyway, more of your thoughts coming later on in the show. For now, let's get back into the final part of today's discussion.
Listening to Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Well, we've been discussing Hinduism, conversion and religious freedom on the programme today. It's in the wake of a number of tensions that have existed in recent years in India between both Muslim, Christian and Hindu groups. Apparently nearly 1,500 physical attacks and death threats were reported against Christians in the past year. But many Hindus see Christian evangelism as a sort of colonial imposition on their culture, and we've heard some of the differences between you both, gentlemen, Henry and Deepan, my guests on the show today. I should just say before we close out today's show, if you want to find out more about the Hindu Council UK, you can go to hinducouncil.org.uk, and CSW, Christian Solidarity Worldwide, that Henry's part of, is csw.org.uk. I'll make sure there are links from today's show for anyone who wants to follow those up. You were saying just in the break, actually, before we started recording again, Deepan, that one of the issues for you is that Hinduism has never, in a sense, had a sort of national identity in the way that some countries have called themselves Christian countries or Muslim countries. Mm-hmm. That doesn't really exist in Hinduism.
No. I was saying, you know, you there are dozens of Christian countries. There are dozens of Muslim Islamic countries. But where is a country for Hindus? You know, it's the third largest religion in the world. You know, you've got Christianity, Islam and Hinduism as the three major religions in the world. And but you see that the proselytizing religions of Islam and Christianity wanting to land grab, essentially.
So you see that the Christian and Islamic influences on India have essentially, yeah, because Hinduism hasn't traditionally been a proselytizing religion itself. It's under threat in that sense, in what has historically been its center in India.
It's always been under threat in that sense. But over 2,000 years, you know, Christianity has a long history with Christianity in India, and then more recently with Islam in India, and then even more recently with political India, where there's communists,
sure,
who want to stake a claim in India. So it's always been what has been seen as a fertile ground by others, where they should be taking it over, or there's a need for them to evangelize.
And would that explain to some extent why the BJP, the RSS, are, in Henry's view, creating a more politicized version of Hinduism to say that is more nationalistic, that's saying, no, this is our land. India is a Hindu country in that sense.
Well, we don't have a land. So, right. You know, it's a question in itself. You know, it's Hinduism. India comprises of Hindus, the majority, 80% are Hindus, according to the last census. There's always, I think, within a country, you always fear losing sovereignty. I mean, this is a prime example, you know. We are going to be leaving Europe, you know, and one of the basis for that was around sovereignty. And I guess when that becomes politicized, or people fear that they're going to lose identity, sovereignty and culture to a foreign import, if I can call that, in terms of Christianity and Islam, then there's bound to be friction, there's bound to be politicization. However, as Hindus themselves, we are not apolitical. We wouldn't we wouldn't say that this we will follow this political party or that political party.
Sure.
We want to make sure that it's fair. People are allowed to come to India. People can preach what they want and can believe what they want. But there should not be a compulsion.
They shouldn't be imposing
or imposing their religion on others.
I mean, do you see things differently to that, Henry? Do you think that what has happened historically and today in India, from Christians in particular, has been an imposition of their beliefs and culture, or has it just been an open-handed kind of invitation? Which, you know, I don't think Deepan has a problem with that, but he sees it has gone too far.
I would say I don't think it's gone too far. I mean, I just want to go back to that question of Deepan talked about identifying a sovereign state with a particular religion. The question that I have is, what is a Christian nation? For example, what does a Christian nation look like? We do know what Muslim nations look like. Buddhist nations look like, because I can think of two examples, the state of Pakistan, for example, and the state of Sri Lanka, for example, both have Islam and Buddhism explicitly stated in the constitution that they have foremost place in the constitution. But what really does a Christian nation look like, for example? I mean, for my understanding is in the West, which is largely secular, which largely respects all religions, and for each of those religions to be able to practice their belief, their traditions. And I think it has worked very well. It has created a space for harmony. And I think I would say India, for a very long time, since its independence in 1947, has been built on that. To now say we need a nation for ourselves, what does that actually mean? Because my thinking is 80% of your population are Hindus. So my concern is, like what we see in Sri Lanka and the uprising that's taken place between the Buddhist nationalists, not Buddhists, but Buddhist nationalists, is a majority of a following of Buddhist nationalism who are having a very minority mindset that we are going to be overtaken by this group of foreigners who are propagating and proselytizing their religion in our place. Now, it once again comes to the fundamentals. No one is forcing you to take this so-called foreign religion or foreign belief. I think India has been built on extremely good. It's probably got one of the best constitutions in the world, you know. And now to move in the direction of identifying us as a Hindu nation is sending out very negative and very concerning.
You think that's a backwards move?
I think so.
Yeah.
I think so. I think what's more important is to look at issues of social injustice, economical injustice that is taking place in the country, than to focus on playing politics on the point of religion, rather, and actually dividing a community that has been living fairly harmoniously for many, many decades. There has been tensions, I believe. There has been tensions, and not to leave out the tension between the partition between Pakistan and India, for example. I mean, Pakistan, if Pakistan was not created, India would probably be one of the largest Islamic populated countries in the world, overtaking Indonesia probably, you know. But that's a different discussion altogether.
Sure.
But there's been relative peace, but not in the last, since the turn of the century.
Decades.
I mean, agree to a point where India has been peaceful, and it is a country which is founded on peace and pluralism. But I guess what it is, I guess you said it yourself, is you have a Christian mission.
Yeah.
You have an Islamic mission. What is your mission? Your mission is to go out there and convert everyone.
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's the rub here, which is that while Henry has no desire to see anyone forced to believe in Christianity, in the imposition. Nonetheless, if by, you know, inviting people to become Christians, more and more people, presumably for you, Henry, yes, you do want all Hindus ultimately, if they're open to it, to accept Jesus Christ. And you think that if that happened, that would be a good thing. Whereas obviously you think deep in that would be a terrible thing for India, presumably.
We could understand Jesus and we would accept his teachings. That's not a problem. It's the mission, because it's the intent which you've come with. The intent is to come into a foreign land and to make it your mission to change everyone to your way of thinking. So you've got, and there's a number of religions and other groups which will come. So you'll have the Muslims who are proselytizing, and you'll have the Christians who are proselytizing in a country which is essentially neutral, which is accepting of both of them.
I mean, it should be said CSW isn't in that sense a proselytizing organization.
No,
it's simply seeking to ensure the rights of Christians to practice their beliefs in freedom. But in a sense, ultimately, as an individual, let's say, Henry, you would like to see Hindus become Christians, that, as a Christian. So is there this is obviously a tension for Deepan, that ultimately that means you're coming here and you're saying everything must change, everyone must believe what we believe.
Yeah. I think to say you are coming here would be misguided. I think it's people who've had ancestry in India who are Christians and Muslims.
Okay.
And if you're talking of Christians who their forefathers were born in India, so it's not a case of you coming here, because when we say you are coming here, you're saying you're already admitting that you are a foreign
religion. What you're saying is that the people doing the evangelizing in India are Indians, not Western powers coming in and
absolutely
missionaries
not.
Coming
and
out.
I think one of the things that the RSS has been promoting is that they've been creating a narrative that Christians are fundamentally being supported by Western nations, which is not true at all, because that is totally wrong. And what you do see at the grassroots levels is that Christians who've been for generations Christians, having Christian traditions, going to church, and in some places you have their own churches, which is a family, a relative church within the street, and they're all Christians in that area. They've been there for hundreds of years. So to create a narrative that it is a foreign religion that is coming in to try and proselytize Hindus is very misguided and very dangerous.
I would disagree with that respectfully, because how old is Christianity? 2,000 years old? How old is Hinduism? You know, arguably over 10,000 years old. How old is Islam? 1,400 years old. How old is Hinduism? Over 10,000 years old. So, yes, these are foreign religions which have come into India. So I would say, you know, in terms of the history of it, they are still relatively new religions compared to Hinduism. So, but what it's doing is imposing its will upon a culture which would find that quite foreign. And I think it's the first time Christians have come across a culture which doesn't persecute others. And I think that's what it finds difficult, because we're not there to proselytize or convert others or persecute others. We would welcome them and welcome their thought and beliefs, but to come into the country and force, by whatever definition of force that we use, to come into a country and impose their beliefs on a culture which is thousands and millennia years older than theirs, it could be seen as arrogant or outrightly divisive.
We should start to wrap up the conversation at this point, but yeah, I think this has been the undercurrent throughout from Deepan, Henry, that, you know, that there's a sense in which he feels that there is an arrogance to the Christian claim, and simply coming and saying, we would like you to become Christians now, is to sort of almost disregard the long tradition and history of Hinduism in India. And I think at the bottom of it, I think that's what Deepin struggles most with here, is it seems to be, well, arrogant, as he puts it.
The 2 points here. One is, let's switch the narrative around. And if you have a situation where you have, I mean, Great Britain has largely been known as a Christian nation. It has its roots in Christianity. And if you had a particular religion coming and proselytizing, for example, I'm not aware of a law that says you can proselytize or you can't share your religion, fundamentally because there is an understanding that you are free to proselytize, to propagate your religion. And I think it's important to go back to this issue of how do you view the other religion. If you see your religion as being open, then I think it's also important to view the religion that is sharing its faith, no matter how arrogant it is, or it may come across to you, that, well, they have a right to do so too. And it must be left to the individual who is being proselytized to then make a decision whether he or she wishes to accept. But to say that you do not have the right to do that, and it sounds very that you're proselytizing an arrogant doctrine, is to fundamentally not respect that particular religion for what it stands for. So I would say, just once again, going back to the Constitution, and I believe there would be attempts to reword the Constitution in India. If the RSS and the BJP has its way, you can already see that with the latest Citizenship Amendment Act. There's already moved to try and marginalize a particular religious minority group. I believe that in the foreseeable future that there might be an opportunity for them to also change the wording of the Constitution and potentially remove the idea of secularism in India.
We're going to have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you both. It's been a really interesting exchange between you. I've learned a lot in the process as well, which is always helpful. And I will encourage people to go and check out the resources as well from both of your organisations, Christian Solidarity Worldwide and the Hindu Council UK. But for now, Deepin and Henry, thanks for joining me on the show.
Thank you. Pleasure. Thank you.
Feel free to get in touch with your thoughts about the show. You can email unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also get in touch via our social media. At UnbelievableJB is the Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. You can find me over on Instagram as well. And of course, we're available with lots of videos these days over on YouTube too. And before I go to some feedback on recent shows and the music we've been playing on the show recently, let me remind you that Unbelievable the Conference is coming Saturday, the 9th of May. Early bird tickets available now, but they won't be around forever. So I do encourage you to book in if you can at unbelievable.live. The theme of this year's conference is how to tell the greatest story ever told, because with Tom Wright and Tom Holland present and the other speakers, I think this is a great opportunity to revisit the big Christian narrative and the way it shaped who we are and what we believe today in the West. That story of the life, death and resurrection of Jesus Christ has been called the greatest story ever told. Yet many in the West have forgotten the story and the way it shapes the values and the life that we hold dear. So this year's conference is really about learning how to tell that life-changing story of Jesus to a new generation of skeptics and seekers. And as usual, there'll be plenary sessions, seminars, Q&A, that live audience edition of the Ask NT Wright Anything podcast as well that we're going to squeeze in there. So do book your seat now, unbelievable.live, and look out for the live streaming options we'll be adding soon to allow you to attend the conference and the Ask NT Wright show from anywhere in the world. This was a lovely little tweet, came from Richard O'Callaghan. I've never met you before, Richard, but this just popped up in my Twitter feed from you, saying, feel compelled to do a shout out for Premier Christian Radio's Unbelievable podcast. I listen to it whenever I'm driving for work. Intelligent debates between believers and non-believers on the important things, expertly chaired by Justin. Highly recommended. Always lovely to receive such encouragement. And this also came in via email. saying, from Shane this was, I'm a left-wing atheist. I don't follow religious or right-wing things at all, yet my two favourite podcasts are Unbelievable and the conservative site for grown-ups, The Bullock. These hip Christian dudes and their awesome vicar are pant-wettingly funny and, like you, appreciate thoughtful atheist perspectives. Thank you very much. Glad you're enjoying the show, Shane. Yes, your thoughts on the bumper music we've been trying, the different tunes over the last few weeks. Last week was quite an epic feel, wasn't it? That sort of orchestral arrangement that Kim Dillon had sent in. Mark, who's a Garnet, who's been a long-time listener, says, to me, EMF's Unbelievable will always be the podcast theme. I'm always a bit disappointed not to hear it. However, I believe that faith evolves and changes and shouldn't be kept from doing so. So, for the sake of consistency, I will accept the new music, different though it is. Thank you very much. Jenny Wynn on Facebook said, I continue to love the Unbelievable podcast and big conversations. Love what God is doing through you and Premier. Just my two cents on the music. I vote for the January the 3rd music. I think that was the show with Douglas Murray and Esther O'Reilly. You said it sounds great on my car stereo and a big improvement to the show. Thanks for all you do. Thank you very much, Jenny. That was her vote. This one from someone tweeting, a developing Christian, they go by on Twitter, says, music isn't that important to me, and I didn't expect to have an opinion on the new intro music quest, but man, I loved this week's music. It makes me feel like I'm about to have a very picturesque view of something beautiful, which is what happens upon listening to your show. So I think you're referring to last week's music, that orchestral sort of introduction to the show, to the Argument from Reason programme. Thank you very much for your vote there. And John Snyder is a composer himself, a full-time one out in LA, says he's benefited greatly from listening to Unbelievable, and was thinking you might benefit from hearing some demo pitches from me with a few different directions before deciding on new music. I'd be happy to help create those. And I have responded to you, John, saying, yes, I would love to hear your pitches, because anything, you know, I think it would be great to have something written specifically for the show. And we'll, you know, I'm seeing this as very much an open source kind of approach that I'm taking to the show's music here at the start of 2020. So if anyone else out there fancies themselves as being able to produce something that might fit with the themes, the tenor, the nature of the Unbelievable show, then feel free to get in touch, and I'm open to all suggestions. Again, it's unbelievable@premier.org.uk to send them in. Let's go for some of your feedback to last week's show. That was Alex O'Connor, the Cosmic Skeptic, as he's known on YouTube, opposite Christian philosopher Max Baker Hitch, debating the Argument from Reason. Quite an abstract argument in many ways, and I hope that we were able to bring it across in helpful ways, that deep philosophical dive we did. The Exodus Project on Twitter said, another great listen. Alex is sharp and insightful as he always is, and who wouldn't benefit from Max as an academic mentor? I learned a lot from him in a short space of time, and it's great to hear yet another sharp intellect on the show defending the theistic worldview. Kay tweets, another interesting conversation, enjoyed it, although it felt more like a precursor to an Argument for God from Reason. Now, there were some criticisms of the way Alex approached that, and some of the objections he raised to this idea that our thoughts have intentionality, and that's hard to square when it comes to the way we do reasoning with a materialistic, naturalistic, physicalist kind of worldview. John Cranman, for instance, said, great listen, though I think Alex kept missing the point about mental stuff like intentionality not being the same as physical stuff. Jerry Jabron said, I just finished listening to the dialogue and I realized that for some odd reason people continue to deal with the problems of metaphysics as a linguistic problem. It's unbelievable. And Pinecone Water said, the combination of intentionality and mental causation are dumb because metaphysical naturalism and logic is transcendent in the same phrase made me turn this off and cry for a whole year. And Aristotle's Jedi says, have to say, I thought the coherence of a physical system producing abstract thought could have been gotten at better. Ross, via Kripke and Quine, is the way to go. Are there no Aristotelians out there who can save the day? And Fabian tweets, great discussion. Anybody bothered by the assertion by Alex, however, that deductive arguments are tautologies? Should we tell all our theoretical physicist friends that they may have been wasting their time arguing in circles? So those were some of the brief comments via Twitter. Here's some longer ones that came in on email. Simon says, thanks for the great discussion between Max and Alex. I really like Max's measured Bayesian approach. For myself, though, the conversation exposed Alex's naturalism as a philosophical position mired by a view of the human brain as a type of deterministic physical information processing computer that could only have evolved by natural selection. In this scenario, the phenomenon of rationality as an expression of mind can only ever sit on top of an underlying physical process. To quote Alex, it's just a question of how we get from natural explanations to talking about minds. He then proposes memory as an example of how naturalism could do the job. Quoting again, it's not a controversial thing to say that it can arise from naturalistic processes. And then Alex promptly backpedals by acknowledging, we don't fully understand or perhaps never will fully understand the brain. It's the most complex thing we've ever discovered in the universe. These are areas like this that are a bit hazy. So human brains, the most complex interface of physical parts and software programming in the universe, can be built with 750 megabytes of genomic data as present in a single fertilized egg. Not to mention that the same data also happens to do a good job of specifying the arrangement of 50 trillion differentiated cells to form an adult human as well. All that is needed is unguided, unintentional, non-purpose processes leveraging differential reproduction over time, and bingo, naturalism can make brains. It's totally fact. We're just working out the details, even if it's a bit hazy. And the evidence for such unguided processes creating anything trivially computational is zero. Yet, if we introduce the mind of a computer scientist or designer, the Bayesian probability suddenly becomes what? As always, podcast has a, as always, your podcast has a Bayesian probability of awesome. Thank you very much. This one from JD Walters says, greatly enjoyed the episode on the argument from reason, and Max Baker Hitch rightly kept the focus on the more fundamental forms of the argument that target the incompatibility of naturalism with intentionality and mental causation, and distinguish those from the separate issues of phenomenal consciousness and the evolutionary version of the argument. But I was a little puzzled by Max's preference for probabilistic over deductive arguments. The fundamental forms of the argument from reason try to establish the incompatibility of naturalism and, for example, intentionality, and either a naturalistic universe can give rise to intentionality or it can't. I don't see the point of trying to cast this argument in Bayesian terms. Is he saying that intentionality in a naturalistic universe, while surprising, is not impossible? That seems to me to unnecessarily weaken the argument. The example of leaves on the lawn that spell out a name do not lead to that conclusion, because even if the wind accidentally arranged leaves to form a name, we only recognise it as a name as beings already having intentionality, and we wouldn't say that the pile of leaves actually had intentional content. The lawn is not thereby storing or transmitting any information whatsoever. I also think that perhaps Alex was not the best person for this discussion, because he seemed genuinely unable to grasp the issues at stake. He conflated intentionality with abstract thought and suggested that because we understand how memories form and are stored, there's no problem of intentionality. He's also incorrect in his reduction of deductive arguments to tautologies. Yes, in deductive arguments, if the premises are true, the conclusion flows necessarily, but that does not mean premises and conclusion are not meaningfully distinct pieces of information. Sound deductive arguments reveal necessary connections between propositions and can clarify our grasp of the space of reasons. All that said, great show as always. Thank you very much. And thanks to others who have got in touch about that show. All the philosophers basically coming out in force for that debate between Max and Alex last week. Always great to have your feedback. Do send it in on this week's show. Be interested to hear what you made of our Hindu debate today. But for now, thanks for being with me. Do come again, same time next week. John Mark Comer from Bridgetown Church in Portland, Oregon, and one of the co-hosts of This Cultural Moment, one of my favourite other podcasts, is going to be sitting down with me to talk about The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. Fantastic new book by him. And he's going to be in conversation with agnostic atheist Buddhist Rachel Holmes as they talk about our anxiety-laden, hurry-driven, tech-addicted culture and what we can do about it. And they'll be speaking from their different perspectives on the show next week. Hope you enjoy that one, and do come again. For now, thanks, and see you next time. You've been listening to The Unbelievable Podcast. Help others find the show by rating and reviewing us in iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts from. And discover more shows from Premier at premier.org.uk/podcasts.